Excuse me. I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the NCSG Open Policy Call on the 16th of January 2012. On the call today, we have Joy Lidicote, Klaus Stoll, Konstantinos Kamatis, Bill Drake, Robin Gross, Alain Béranger, Sarah Longdon-Hall, David Cake, Michael Hafley, Timothy Lipp, Avi Doria, and Lan Wenzai. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay, so let me just very quickly review what's on the agenda today. The first issue to discuss is an open discussion on the membership criteria for joining the non-commercial stakeholder group, what that means. There's been some questions and some confusion, and people aren't sure if individuals can join or what kinds of organizations are eligible for membership. And some of the NPOC members of the executive committee requested that we have a broader discussion on this topic, and so we put it on the agenda discussion for last month, but unfortunately none of them came to the call, so we've put it on the discussion again for this month, hoping that we can kick off that discussion and get that discussion going. And then the second issue will be to focus more on the GNSO Policy Council and what the issues are that are currently before the council, and there's a meeting on Thursday of this week, so there'll be some votes other motions and issues that will be discussed before the council, and I'm sure the councilors would like to get some feedback from the membership in general on these issues and vice versa. So those are basically the two things that we're going to talk about today. So unless anybody has any questions on that or would like to add anything to the agenda, I'd suggest let's get started. Okay, so the first issue then is what does it mean to be a non-commercial organization? I think we should sort of maybe divide up this discussion into two parts. One is individuals and one is organizations, since we allow membership of both organizations and individuals. So let's try to separate our discussion for these purposes and first talk about organizations and what kinds of organizations are eligible for membership. And actually, the non-commercial stakeholder group charter is pretty instructive. If you take a look at, in particular, section 2.2.1, eligible organizations, the basic criteria is the organization is incorporated as a non-commercial entity in countries that have such a provision in there, or if they're unincorporated or operating in a country without those provisions for non-commercial incorporation, that they operate on a not-for-profit basis, primarily for non-commercial purposes. And you have to be the exclusive user of at least one domain name, and this means a non-commercial domain name because this is the non-commercial stakeholder group. So, again, eligibility is tied to having a non-commercial domain name, since we are participating in the policy development of the generic top-level domains. It's important that there be that tie to generic top-level domains. And the organization should be engaged in online activities that are primarily non-commercial, including advocacy, education, religious, human rights, charitable, scientific, artistic. Again, this is not an exclusive list, but illustrative, some ideas. And in the case of a membership-based organization, the organization should not only be non-commercial itself, but should have primarily a non-commercial focus. And the membership should also have a non-commercial focus in the activities that it undertakes. And then there's a listing in the charter of the types of organizations that are per se ineligible for membership, in the non-commercial stakeholder group. And this includes political organizations whose primary purpose is to hold government office or elect government officials, commercial organizations and associations that advocate for the benefit of commercial entities, and this even if they are nonprofit in form, if they are still advocating for the benefit of commercial entities, they would be ineligible. Organizations that are represented in ICANN through another supporting organization specified in the bylaws or GNSO stakeholder group, organizations that are under contract with ICANN, and governmental organizations or governmental departments, whether local, regional, or national, and intergovernmental organizations whose membership primarily includes nation states. So those are the six types of organizations that are ineligible, per se, for membership in the non-commercial stakeholder group. So that's kind of what lays out what the charter says on this issue of, you know, who's eligible and who's not eligible. And I just wanted to open this up again because it was a request from the NPOC members to have this discussion, so we're having it again. And I want to open this up, and if anyone has any comments or criticisms or suggestions or anything to say about again, please try to keep this to organizational members for this part of the discussion, and then we can talk about individuals in a few minutes. Okay, I see Avery has her hand raised. Great. Go ahead, Avery.
Yeah, I have a quick question, and while this applies to organizational, it'll apply to the individuals also. One of the things I always had, and I should have known while I was working with the charter, but one of the questions I always have that even when I asked, I never could get an answer, and that's why it says primarily non-commercial. Because so many people's websites these days have a window on the side or a frame on the side with click ads. And I've never been certain that those did not ruin the non-commerciality of a name of a website. Now, that was always my personal feeling, and I was never able to get any sort of consensus. That's why people think, so that's why there's nothing in there, and it speaks of primarily non-commercial purposes. But I'd really be interested in throwing into this discussion at some point an understanding, a clarification of if you have a website that is about something non-commercial, but you've got ads up and down the sides of the frames, is it still non-commercial? Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. Did anybody else want to have a comment on this? I think Avery has really kind of hit the nail on the head here in terms of looking at the criteria and where the distinction lies, and that's in, you know, purely non-commercial. And so there's some judgment calls to be made there, and where do we draw the line? I mean, certainly, you know, every NGO that I know of has place on their website where they take money, they take donations, or perhaps sell advertising space. So, you know, I mean, I think that taking a really hard line on that would disqualify just about all of our members, organizational members who use the web to get money. But on the same token, you know, at what point does this something become really a commercial operation or really for the benefit of commercial entities? And I think that's really kind of the heart of the question that we need to have a discussion on today. So did anybody else have anything they wanted to add on that?
Yes, this is Klaus.
Yes,
I would like to make two comments. As you know, I'm involved since many years of running non-profit organizations. You have to understand from my point of view that the basis for funding over the years has completely changed. It was possible to run a non-profit up till maybe 5 or 6 years ago on donations, grants, and things like that. But since basically the concept of development aid and charity went to multi-sector partnership concept, it is just simply impossible for anybody to run a foundation without having some kind of link with a commercial partner, or B, doing some activities which in a way generate funds in a very, very commercial way. Completely dissociated from any kind of organization I know or is present here at that conversation is, for example, if you have a foundation which is supporting a cause, but at the same time is selling commercially books about this cause and uses the profits of these books in order to promote the cause and keep the foundation afloat, this is just simply the reality of what we have nowadays in funding. And the other important thing is, I point out, and coming back to the Charter, I think we should respect what the Charter says. For example, if there is an organization which basically is registered as a 501(c)(3) or in another form as a non-profit in their country, we should try, in my opinion, to respect this registration as a non-profit and not asking questions again and again and again about if the level of property the country has set or the jurisdiction in which the foundation is has set is sufficient for us. She said there is also a very, very clear limitation. We have to be aware that under the guise of corporate social responsibility and there are a lot of so-called foundation and non-profits around, which are basically nothing else than the commercial arm of some kind of company. A very good one, a very worthy one is, for example, Microsoft Partners in Learning. But this is a part of Microsoft and is there to promote Microsoft and help them to access markets. So this we can't call. So basically, I think on the one side we have to be wise who's what, but on the other side we just simply take as one granted criteria: if somebody is registered in their jurisdiction as a non-profit, we should respect that. Thank you.
Well, this is Tim. I agree with most of what was said, except for the if someone is registered as a nonprofit, we have to accept it. The fact is that many of the organizations, you know, you listed are in fact listed as nonprofit, and so I think one has to take another level of examination to figure out what the eligibility is. Now, maybe that's looking at that organization's charter. I sort of hate to say maybe it means looking at the candidate organization's behavior, because sometimes the behavior and the charter become disconnected over time. But I think, you know, this is fundamentally a fuzzier thing than anyone would really like it to be. But as you say, the way in which organizations have to live in this environment has changed. I mean, if I look at, you know, a university, which most people would, you know, a not-for-profit university organized as not-for-profit. We didn't used to have the profit ones. But, I mean, even take, you know, a Harvard or an MIT kind of university, and then you turn around and say, but they have a huge corporate licensing thing. They get grants from commercial and governmental organizations. They turn around and sell and fund startup companies. You go, well, I still think they're fundamentally non-commercial, but they have this huge appendage sitting on the side. And so, you know, I don't think it's as simple as having a bright line test. I think it has to be, you know, certainly looking at the organization's charter. And maybe we have to have some set of criteria for looking at behavior.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, it's even in the charter that even if an organization is nonprofit in its legal form, that if they're still advocate for the benefit of commercial entities and commercial organizations, they're still ineligible. So it's not the, you know, it can't be the end of the inquiry whether or not it's, you know, recognized as a nonprofit in its own jurisdiction, because, you know, the Recording Industry Association of America is a nonprofit organization, but they're obviously not eligible for membership in NCSG because they advocate for the benefit of commercial entities. So, you know, it's it may be one piece of evidence towards a larger picture that shows an organization is a true non-commercial organization, but in and of itself, you know, the charter is really clear that it's not the only criteria that that organizations that are legally non-profit are still ineligible if they advocate for commercial benefits or for commercial organizations. So I think we have to look a little bit deeper and have to, you know, have to have a little bit more of a nuanced and more subtle understanding.
Right. So,
I've got a queue going here. I've got, I think, Bill, you were next, and Joy, and then who else has their hand up?
Can David? I add myself to that?
Who is that?
David.
Okay, so I've got, let me just get this right. I've got Bill, I've got Joy, I've got David, and then I've got Alan. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, everybody. We've had these conversations off and on the list for as long as I've been involved in any, not just in ICANN, but in any civil society coalitions and so on. And so when it feels a certain sense of deja vu, I think it's, to me, it's clear that, as Robin was just saying, tax status is not a sufficient criteria. The International Chamber of Commerce is a nonprofit, according to Industry of America, on and on and on. And they're advocates for commercial interests. So I think it's, I think it ought to be obvious enough that that's not within the domain of what we're doing here. As to whether having advertisements on your website or soliciting a little bit of funding by, for example, selling books makes you a commercial entity, I mean, that to me, I don't know. I guess if we want to get into really existential, ontological discussions, we can. But, I mean, the fundamental purpose, let's take some concrete examples. The Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington, D.C. is there to advocate for the privacy rights of individual citizens. It sells books in order to raise funding. That doesn't mean that it's a commercial entity in the sense that it's trying to make a profit or advocate for the private sector. Same would be true of the Media Access Center. Same would be true of, you know, endless number of public interest organizations and non-governmental organizations I can think of. So I guess we could dwell on the complexities of the boundaries, and I understand, Avery, maybe you want to do that. But in terms of the fundamental issue, I mean, I think that people have an intuitive sense of what the non-commercial representation in ICANN has historically been about, and I can't understand why we would want to change that or blur the boundaries in such a way that organizations that advocate for business, which is 95% of ICANN anyway, would then be brought into NCSG. It just strikes me as really unhelpful and a distraction from the things that we really need to be focusing on. So I'll just stop there.
Thanks so much, Bill. Joy, you're next. Joy?
Sorry, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Firstly, I suppose it would be helpful to hear more from persons who'd wanted this discussion in terms of the new issues they're feeling that have been raised that require us to look afresh at membership criteria. so that I could understand those better. But I suppose my take on this discussion is that I go back to first principles as to why it is that ICANN has a non-commercial constituency. And in that vein, you know, my view is it's so that we have richer, more diverse and more representative views amongst the multi-stakeholder voices in ICANN that particularly are able to articulate the non-commercial interests of internet users. So I think merely looking at the form in which those views are presented, in other words, purely some line in the sand about non-commercial companies or the form in which non-commercial groups take, I would agree is inadequate. I think something more substantive is needed in terms of the views that are being advocated for and the interests that are being advocated for and whether they are non-commercial in that broader public interest sense. And there I think some exercise beyond mere assertion of non-commerciality is necessary if we're to maintain the overall integrity of the non-commercial stakeholder group, you know, for the very first principles purpose for which it's been established. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Joy. Next, I've got David and then Alan.
All right. I just wanted to say, I don't think the issue about the I mean, pretty much many, many non-commercial organisations sell some, you know, do various kinds of fundraising, some of which will be selling things. I don't really think it's, I mean, fundamentally, you know, an organisation selling a few T-shirts or, you know, Girl Guide selling cookies or whatever isn't really fundamentally any different from website ads. Website ads might be a bit tackier, but I don't think the point is the same. Non-commercial organisations can engage in a bit of commercial activity for fundraising from time to time. We're looking at the basic purpose of the organisation. I think there's also a point at which we have to sort of look at some of these issues in the sense of the broader ICANN context. What we're really looking for when commercial which is the point where we feel an organisation belongs in the CSG, not the NCSG. I don't think we should, you know, I'd hate to see us sort of having organisations stuck in limbo that no one would want to have in either. And similarly, the intergovernmental organisations, you know, there's a place for them. We don't need to offer them a place here. They already have a place within ICANN. I think that's part of what it is. Is it at that tipping point where it tips over from one to the other is really the issue, rather than arguing about what, you know, how best to define our criteria. We shouldn't define them too narrowly. Well, that's pretty much it.
Thanks, David. Alan.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, I don't know the history of how the non-commercial stakeholders group came about, but it is defined as by what it's not. So if we say we are clear about what is commercial, then everything else is acceptable as a member in NCSG. I think donations are the rule rather than the exception in the not-for-profit sector, and more as was pointed out. Through sponsorship or program funding, or through even ads, organizations get funding from commercial organizations. But it does raise. Probably we need to solve this on a case by case point, because I was thinking if you take the telecenter.org organization, it's a foundation, it's a not-for-profit foundation. And it's got two major social investors, that's how they call themselves, on the site. And the one is the Canadian government through a Crown Corporation, which is a not-for-profit group, and then Microsoft. And but looking at the work that telecenter.org does, you can see that they advocate for connectivity in the bottom 2 billion and consumers, and they do training for how to better operate a telecenter, and they do knowledge exchange, and it's mostly non-commercial. But it, the more they are active, the more it benefits the sponsor. So we are in a gray zone. I find it, I agree with most that has been said. When you think about the non-for-profit associations that represent for-profit members, like the Recording Association, the Recording Industry Association, or the American Banking Association, and then even then, the advocacy can be for the banking sector, but the advocacy can also be for better financial knowledge by the consumer. So there you have an organization that does good work for a large section of the population, but it also at the same time does very narrow promotional advocacy work for the industry. So the other one that I find so if we are everything else that is not commercial, then it's we probably have all the criteria correct, and just recognizing that even in the education sector, for instance, at one end of the sector you'll have a free tuition open university on the web, all the way up to an MIT in the US or Schulich School in business in Canada, where it's hard, although it's for education purposes, only the rich can go and study there mostly, and they do. So then that's fine. So everything that is non-commercial, and we can always have a review, and in cases which seem at a tipping point. What I find more, I understand our chair has asked us to separate the discussion between organizations and individuals, and I find that I find this is where there is a bit of a difficulty, because if you're I'm thinking of one of our members in particular, but I think it can be generalized. If you work for a large commercial organization, some echo. If you work for a large commercial organization and then you are registered or you're a member of NCSG as an individual, well, I guess you speak as an individual, but what stops you from being an advocate for some important movement or important cause that benefits your employer? Or so I find that our stakeholders group is a very.
Sounds like somebody's microphone is on.
Yeah.
Can everyone be sure to mute their microphones?
Okay. So what I wanted to say is that we, by definition, because we are everything but commercial, then we have a very diversified membership. And what I've learned in other types of association is that sometimes it may be easier to have a narrower memberships, but that's not the case. But anyway, I want to point out that the difficulties for me are in individual memberships, because you really don't know where the influence is or the statement is coming from. And then it's also the matter of balancing the voice. If you're a representative for an NGO as an organization, then you speak for your NGO, presumably. But maybe that's not the case. So then what's the purpose of having an institutional membership? And if you're an individual working for a commercial organization and you're a member of NCSG, why is that? And you you could also be active on for your employer on the commercial side of the house. So I don't know if my comments helped, but since we raised the issue as newcomers to the stakeholders group, I thought I wanted to share with you some of my views and hesitations on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Let's see. Next, I think Konstantinos has his hand raised. Go ahead, KK.
Thank you, Robin. Hello, everybody. I have to admit I'm a little bit perplexed with the previous comment made by Alan, Alain. I think that if I understood correctly what he is referring to, he seems to be implying that we cannot be sure whether individual members actually represent themselves or their employers. On that basis, I could argue exactly the same about organizations. We can never be sure whether the organizations do exactly as they preach or they're striking deals behind closed doors. And in any case, I have to admit that I feel a little bit uncomfortable having this discussion in this space. I really do not believe that this is a policy issue. And since we are discussing, and as chair of NCUC, who consists of many, many individual members, I think that this is a discussion that needs to open up to the whole of the membership. And needless to say that there is a very clear charter of NCUC that pre-exists the one of NCSG, where it's clearly stated that individual members should be allowed. This is my contribution, but in any case, I would strongly recommend that we take this back to the membership because it really affects a lot of the members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, KK. I think you're right. We need to have this discussion as broad as possible. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I was put on this call, and also I agree with you about, you know, let's take it to the list and bring in more participants than only those who were able to participate in today's telephone meeting. But it does seem like, you know, from what we're hearing, that there really isn't going to be any kind of acceptable bright line test. And, you know, we really have to look at these organizations carefully and really on a case-by-case basis, you know, do some evaluating and use some judgment. And, you know, there's a lot of different criteria that we can look at, you know, but ultimately it is the non-commercial stakeholder group executive committee that makes the decision of who to accept or reject into the membership. And, you know, so that's, you know, that's really kind of the important place where these decisions are being made. However, that executive committee is only authorized to take direction from the membership. So, again, it really must come back to the membership of the stakeholder group and, you know, for everyone to really be engaged and participate in this discussion. With respect to individual membership, since we've kind of started talking about what kinds of individuals are eligible for membership, let me just go to the charter and okay, and see what the charter says. Again, it's very instructive. Section 2.2.5, individual persons who agree to advocate for a non-commercial public interest position within the stakeholder group and who fall within one of the following three criteria are eligible to join as an individual member. The first criteria is an individual who has registered a domain name for personal, family, or other non-commercial use. The second category is an individual internet user who is primarily concerned with the non-commercial public interest aspects of domain name policy and is not represented in ICANN through membership in another supporting organization or GNSO stakeholder group. Or three, an individual who is employed by or a member of a non-member non-commercial organization such as universities, colleges, large NGOs can join NCSG in his or her individual capacity if their organization has not already joined the NCSG. The executive committee shall at its discretion determine the limits to the total number of individuals who can join from any single organization. And an individual who is a member of or an employee of a non-commercial organization which is itself a member of NCSG may apply for or retain membership in the NCSG only under the first criteria for individual membership, which is the one where you've registered a domain name for personal, family, or other non-commercial use. So that's the rules as set forth in the charter for what types of individuals are eligible for membership. And frankly, it's pretty broad. You know, individuals who agree to advocate for a non-commercial public interest position and they've got a non-commercial domain name or they're concerned with a non-commercial policy, they're employed by or a member of a non-commercial organization. This is very broad, and, you know, we wanted it when we drafted these a few years ago to be broad because we wanted to welcome a broad range of individuals into the stakeholder group for membership. But, you know, we've had some concerns raised about should we allow individuals? Well, we have. It's in the charter, but, you know, I guess the question is should we change that? So I just want to kind of open it up and see if there's anyone who has anything to say about individual membership and how that is procedurally brought through the stakeholder group. Okay. I don't see any hands raised.
It's Klaus. I'm sorry. I got connected from the Adobe Connect room.
Okay.
And the thing is, the only point I would make on the individual membership is I think it is important to have individual membership. But the question is, can we so freely mix up and put on the same level individual membership with the institutional membership? So the question is the voice or the vote of one person having one use the same weight as an organization with a large number of members? I think that might be the only question I have there.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand. So you're saying should an individual be allowed in when we allow in large organizations? I mean, they have different weights when it comes to votes. An individual has one vote and a large organization has four votes. So I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're saying. If we should allow in one, we shouldn't allow in the other or something?
No, I think if the question for me is mixing it up and putting it all in, it's important. has four votes. Are they really in the same forum? This is a question. It's not a judgment for me.
Yeah.
And by the way, just as a side comment, I find, even if it is very repetitive, I find the whole discussion very rewarding.
Great. Happy to hear that. Well, I think the question comes down to what is the non-commercial stakeholder group to begin with? And I think we represent non-commercial interests. And those interests could take shape in organizations, but I think they also take shape in individuals that, you know, people don't necessarily have to form an organization in order to have a valid, legitimate non-commercial interest that they want to advocate and you know, represent in the GNSO policy development process. So, I mean, I think, you know, kind of saying, well, these are apples and oranges because they're individuals and organizations is perhaps not the right way to look at it because it ultimately comes back to what interest is trying to be represented here, and it is a non-commercial interest. And you know, what the particular form in which it takes shape, I don't think is particularly relevant, or at least as relevant as, you know, what are the objectives and what is the interest that is trying to be put forward. And that's my view, but again, I'd really like to hear what others have to say on this.
Well, this is Tim. I did stick my hand up, but I guess you don't see it.
I didn't see it, no, so please go ahead. And
so,
if anyone else has their hand up, please tell me because I don't see it.
Yeah, I've got my hand up, too.
Okay.
Yeah, I see that. So let me start with, I am an individual member. I have at various times in a long career worked in commercial organizations and non-commercial organizations. But I have my own domain name. Actually, I have several of them for primarily, you know, I run a family network that some people have said, you know, looks like a corporation because I have family scattered throughout the world, and the domain name and the services behind that are what tie it together. So I can do printer sharing with family members, you know, across the Atlantic from me. I guess the reason I ended up becoming a member is I had a set of issues, and someone said to me, say, you know, aren't you a member of? And I said, never heard of it. And, well, then, who represents you in the process? And the answer is, individual members, as far as I can tell, are represented in ICANN only by NCSG. Now, the question of, you know, if I speak, you know, in one of these forums, you know, am I surreptitiously representing my employer? Well, no. First, because the issues tend to be different, and second, because I have a disclaimer on everything I write that says doesn't necessarily represent the view of my employer. And if it did, I'd say so. So, I mean, I think there's an obligation for an individual to who may be perceived as having multiple interests to indicate which ones are being represented when he or she speaks. But if you have the notion that if you kick us out, there's some other place for us to go, please tell me what that is. I guess silence means there is no other place for me to go.
Great. Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I think Alan is next.
Yeah, in fact, mine is not a comment. It's a question. I was for two more knowledgeable members of this group. If I am an individual and I want to be active and I can. I know I can do it through NCSG. But can I do it through at large too? And if so, what is the difference, and is there actually a place for individuals? Is there more than one place for individuals to go, and is there overlap then, if that's the case?
Yeah, there is some overlap, and that's a really good question. I'm glad you brought it up, because it's important to sort of highlight the distinctions between the two organizations, who often have a lot in common. We're often the non-commercial stakeholder group, and the at-large communities are generally thought of as quote-unquote civil society, and so we do share a lot of similarities, but there are some important distinctions that are worth pointing out. And first is has to do with sort of the scope of the work that the two different organizations look at. The at-large structures and ALAC really look at all of ICANN's systems and policies, and the NCSG focuses primarily on GNSO policy development. We're part of the GNSO, and so that's our main focus. So that's one really important distinction. And then the other really important distinction is that the non-commercial stakeholder group is the only part of ICANN that is purely non-commercial, that the at-large has individuals who are commercially oriented and individuals who are non-commercially oriented. So they get quite a mix of commercial and non-commercial interests in at-large, and the NCHG is purely non-commercial. So those are two really important distinctions for people to understand in terms of thinking about, you know, where's the right place for me to go, and, you know, what is the interest that I want to represent, and how do we get there?
Well, this is Tim. I guess there's one other thing I ought to say. As an individual, I'm so non-commercial but I can't get a trademark. And if you look at all the issues that we have floating around, you know, who can own a domain name and who can steal a domain name from someone who has one and reallocate and all this stuff, it always seems to come down to, trademarks trump everything. So I'm probably more purely non-commercial as an individual than any of the organizations here, because all the organizations seem to be able, you know, to get trademarks and then turn around and say, this is how I protect my domain name. Someone, you know, who trademarks, you know, my family name has some ability to deprive me of my domain name.
Okay. Let's see. It looks like I've got some hands raised. Avery, yeah. Constantinos, and Bill.
Okay. Avery, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great, because I'd gone back and forth a couple times. I wasn't sure what state I was in. I definitely must support the continuation of individuals. That's critical. In fact, I would go the other way when doing the comparison of individuals to organizations. I think in many of our organizations that have two votes and four votes, there really is only one individual participating. And, yes, someone in the organization has signed off for something, but I think very often a lot of our organizations have actually gotten extra weight by virtue of an individual having the letter of their organization behind them. So I would in no way denigrate individual membership by saying, who do they represent? I think it's critical. I think it's really quite good that the NCSG has it. My only caveat is on what it means to be a non-commercial individual website. And I'll bring up the same point I brought up before, that I think if my individual website has all kinds of click-for-pay and advertisements on it, and considering that under the organizational thing, we heard that, well, maybe it's a valid way for organizations to raise money, and I'll grant you, I understand organizations have to do all kinds of things to try and get money. For an individual, that would not seem to be applicable. So I would think that having something like Tim's wide network that includes all families is certainly a good thing. But I would think that anybody that uses their website as a method of pay-per-click and other advertising, that would not count. I think things that hit the fuzzy border there is if you use your website to try and get yourself a job. That is borderline. But I think putting up advertising goes over the limit for someone that would be an individual. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Avery. Bill, looks like you're next.
All righty. Well, Avery just said something that I was going to say, so I can simply say amen to that. I mean, I do think it's a real issue that if we're going to start to problematize individual membership, we have to think carefully about whether or not all the people who might participate as organizational representatives are really fully, deeply reporting to and accountable to the full membership and have the mandate of the full membership of their organizations. And I think many times that would actually not be the case. But more generally, I think I would just say that the kind of notion that the world breaks down into sort of organizations strikes me as just really archaic and sort of like a corporatist practice of the 1950s, you know. We had this problem in the OECD when we set up the Civil Society Advisory Group. I went through this with them. I went through it in Uralo. I've been on the board of Uralo for several years. And we didn't have individual rights in Uralo either. And it's always a problem because it just doesn't map very well with the Internet environment anymore. We're talking about citizens who are active in the Internet space, who are empowered to participate and represent their own interests, and the notion that they have to somehow join some sort of group in order to be legitimate participants somehow would be, to me, quite extraordinary. And it's actually, somebody asked about how it's being done in the different Rallos on the ALEC site. I mean, I'll just finish by saying. And the solution that we found, I guess, in Uralo, which hasn't been implemented yet, is not really very satisfactory, which is that all the individuals would be lumped together into a single at-large structure like any other structure. So now I'm hearing like crickets, which is very interesting. So anyway, that kind of way of representing individuals I think doesn't work either. Evan can talk about what they do in Neuralo, but I think bottom line is individuals should be fully empowered to participate, and I don't see any real cause for confusion. You know, there is weighted voting, and the dynamics of conversations can't be controlled based on one's ontological status. So I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks so much for that, Bill. It doesn't look like anybody else has their hand raised, so if somebody would like to speak, please say so now. Okay, great. And then sort of the third and smaller issue on this issue of membership criteria is organizations that live in the CCTLD space. And the reason I bring this up is because we received an application for an organization to join NCSG recently that doesn't have a generic top-level domain, a .org or something. What it's got is a country code domain. And we thought, well, geez, they don't even participate. They're not even part of the GNSO. Do they understand that they're represented in the CCNSO? And, you know, I mean, it really kind of surprised us to get this kind of membership application, and it ties in with this discussion of, well, you know, are we right in saying that they shouldn't, that they're not eligible in NCSG because they don't have a generic top-level domain because they're represented in the CCNSO? So opening up that question, if anyone has any comments or thoughts on that.
So I guess I don't understand the politics. I mean, no one in this group owns, you know, .com, .edu, or, you know, any of the real top-level domains. So everyone's under something.
Right. What I'm saying is we're in the generic space and not the country code space.
Right. If you happen to live in a place that lives under a country code, well, what's the difference? I mean, I have a domain name, you know, under .net, and I have another one under .us. And,
I think,
you know, so someone else is under .jp or .com.jp, and what's the real distinction here?
The distinction is that policy made in the GNSO affects what happens in a .org, but doesn't affect what happens in a .us. That policy gets made over in the CCNSO or in those country codes. So, you know, it's kind of like you want to participate in the forum in which you live, that, you know, the policies that come out of the GNSO will, in fact, apply to your non-commercial domain name. Just, so it looks like we've got a few hands here. I see Bill, Joy, and Alan. Bill, you have the floor?
No, I'm sorry. My hand is still from before.
Okay, that's from last time. Okay, so then I've got Joy, and then I've got Alan.
Thank you. I'm just speaking, of course, as somebody who is the chair of the regulator in the .nz CCTLD space, although that's not the interest that I represent when I'm in the NCUC. And I would just say, you know, from that perspective, i.e. the .nz perspective, that I also would be a little surprised to see a CCTLD seeking representation in the NCSG space, not because a CCTLD is always commercial. Of course, they may not be, and in fact, .nz operates as a not-for-profit charitable company, but rather that the space in which those CCTLD interests are represented is the CCNSO space, with which the GNSO has a relationship, of course, and through which NCSG interests are represented by the GNSO council members. So I'm a little perplexed as to why the request has been made, and I suppose I would seek more information about that.
Great, thank you. Yes, we have asked, you know, I haven't gotten a response back, if they understood that the GNSO doesn't make policy for where they live, that the CCNSO is the forum in which they live. And, you know, just trying to clarify if they understood what they're applying to. And I haven't heard back yet, but I'll, you know, that's what kind of brought this discussion about. Alan, you are next in the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a clarification. I raised the issues of my comfort level in memberships from organizations and versus membership from individuals. That was not motivated as a matter of being exclusive. If anything, I agree with the speaker before. If anything, the internet era has showed us that, you know, inclusivity is very important, and that's why we fight for connectivity in the poorer countries. The issue is that it's not NCSG that has made that's making the only rules. There is a place for everyone in ICANN, I hope it is the case. So it's not so much as, you know, putting in raising the issue of individual membership as being a desire for exclusivity. No, it's a matter of having the right groupings for the attacking the right issues. And of course, I think good arguments have been made for having a mixed membership. And the reason why we at NPOC prefer to limit our membership to institutional or organizational membership is because we are concerned about the place of all types of NGOs around the world. And right now, the smaller the NGO and the more underdeveloped the economy, the most unlikeliness that NGO will be a member of ICANN. So I that's what I wanted to add as a clarification.
Great. Thanks so much. Looks like we've got hands raised from Tim and David. Okay. Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. So I've listened to the last little bit, and as an individual, I've got to say that I have this feeling of creeping hopelessness. And I say that because, I'm an individual, and it happens that for various reasons I have domain names under several of the top-level domains. And what I'm hearing is, there's only one of me. I mean, it's not like I'm an organization of five people. There's just one of me. I mean, how many places do I have to plug into in order to try and advocate for having domain names that are usable by individuals and not, you know, preemptable by other random people? The other thing I ought to throw in is, you know, we all focus on websites because they're popular. I don't have a public website. Everything I have is, you know, restricted to, you know, my corner of the universe. So, you know, anything that says you're going to look at my website and decide if I have advertising or not, you know, this is a private world. I mean, unless you have the appropriate authentication credentials, you know, whether they're, you know, X509 certificates or physical tokens or, you know, God knows what. I mean, it's my family. You know, the only thing that matters is, you know, my domain name. I need to be able to get one, and I need to be able to manage it, and I need to make sure that, you know, various kinds of thieves and policy decisions, you know, don't take it away.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks very much for that. And it looks like the last word on this topic will be from David.
I just want to say I was a bit surprised when this rule came up. I couldn't actually, can't find the wording in the charter that specifically forbids specifically forbids CCTLD for qualifying. As far as I was concerned, the only right wording I can find is just be the exclusive user. So I'm not even sure quite where the rule came from, but maybe I'm missing something later. But I find it a very odd rule. The fact that my organization I represent, as it happens, we have other domain names under .com that we control, but we normally use a .au domain name. It seems very odd that that would be the criteria, because we certainly are not represented.
Let me ask you, David, what happens, what policy is going to come out of the GNSO that's going to have any impact on .au? I mean, the two are entirely unrelated. So where's the connection?
That's the point, is my organization, we normally use our .au or, address, and we have others, but we certainly, because we're a lobbying organization based on online civil rights, we certainly have an interest in what goes on in the GTLD space overall, even if that's not the domain name we use for our individual organization usually. So it seems an odd way of determining whether or not you have an interest in that policy space.
Whether or not you have registered a domain name in that space is an odd way of determining whether or not you have an interest in that space?
Well, you know, a policy interest, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a bit like kind of, as I said, do you have an interest in, say, you know, policy on the roads based on whether or not you own a car? The policy reasons for involving that space can be a lot higher.
Okay. Did anyone else have anything they need to add, they want to add to this topic, or should we move on to the GNSO issues, the policy issues? Okay. Great. Well, I think we've had some good opening discussions here, and again, I want to invite folks to take the issues to the main list, and you know, let's get a full and fair hearing of all sides and all concerns, and see where to go from here. Okay. So on the GNSO council policy issues and status updates and pending votes and all that good stuff for Thursday's call, there's a lot of things on the agenda. On the IRTP Part B recommendations, and I'm glad we've got some counselors on the call today, because I'm not really, I'm just wondering if somebody could explain to us what these matters are and what's in CSG's concern on the IRTP Part B recommendations. If we can start with that. Who do we have on the call from our counselors? We've got Bill and Mary and Joy and what are counselors? Wendy. can anybody tell us about this IRTP Part B recommendations? It looks like there's a lot of things on the GNSO's agenda this week. Okay, so nobody's sure. Bill, Mary. Okay, we can come back to this one if this one is not the where we should.
Robin, I'm sorry, this is Konstantinos. Wendy is typing on chat that she saw nothing of concern in the IRTP recs.
Okay.
So I'm not sure whether that's enough, but this was on the chat. Thanks.
Okay, great. Well, then we can come back to that one if we need to. I know there are a couple other issues that are on the agenda that are more concerned to the NCSG. It looks like Mary says she's trying to raise her hand, but Wendy already said what she's going to say. Okay. Okay, so let's go on to the next issue, which is the ICANN outreach efforts to increase participation, because I know this is something that our counselors have been somewhat involved with, and the CSG has had some proposals, and the staff has had some proposals, and it's gotten a little bit confusing in terms of what's going on. But do we have any counselors who can give us an idea of what's happening this week or in general on this issue?
Bill.
Bill.
Yeah, I guess I can. Well, what's happening is that we're going to talk a little bit and boot it down, kick the can down the road, and try to take the matter up in a more focused manner in San Jose. The brief background on this, because we've gone through this on multiple calls, is simply been that there was a outreach task force that drafted a set of recommendations. There was a working group that created a set of recommendations for an outreach task force that would be a multi-stakeholder process to have some coordination among stakeholder groups in terms of their outreach activities to ensure that there's some consistency, transparency, and so on. There was, I think, an expectation on the part of a lot of people that this was a non-problematic thing that would just go through. And then it turned out that, long story short, at the 11th hour, before a recent meeting, I believe the January meeting, might be earlier, the CSG decided that it did not support this. And so the motion to adopt the outreach task force model failed. And the idea was supposed to be that they were going to come back with an alternative proposal, which would be vetted and discussed with everybody. There was no vetting or discussion. And then at the 12th hour, just before the next council meeting, they put forward a new motion that would have us have the ICANN staff basically taking lead on some things and defer any other action in the hope that essentially this would end up being something controlled at the level of stakeholder groups, including money, which is, I guess, a concern. And nobody seconded that motion, so that went down to defeat. So people have been rather confused as to what their respective interests are. And at the same time that all this has been going on, there have been other initiatives at other levels, including the staff, which have not been terribly transparent or well understood by everybody. There's been an initiative with the SOAC chairs to talk about outreach efforts and so on. It's been very hard to get information about what all's going on there. And so it's all a rather confused picture now at this point. So we're going to talk about it on the call and then hopefully circle back to it in San Jose with a more focused face-to-face discussion, by which point hopefully there will be better information. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much for that update, Bill. That's really helpful. Does anyone else have anything they want to add on this subject? David, it looks like your hand is up. Is that from before, or did you want to add something?
Oh, no, sorry, that's from before.
Okay. So let's see. The next issue on the agenda is the UDRP and the review of the UDRP. And that's another issue that's been moving through the GNSO. So do we have a counselor or a policy committee member who can update us on what's happening with the UDRP review?
Robin, I can speak briefly and everybody else, you know, someone else can actually jump in and add. There's nothing happening. I mean, it's really straightforward and easy, apart from what was decided
so
in
where
the
are
previous
we
GNSO meeting, which is that the GNSO, my understanding is the GNSO has committed to start the UDRP review no later than 18 months after the new GTLDs have been delegated. So the clock will start ticking as soon as the delegation takes place, and that is 18 months, after the delegation. So that's all I have. Maybe Mary, Bill, or someone else from the councilors have anything more to add, but that's my understanding where we are right now. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, KK. Mary, is her hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Thanks, KK. So I don't really have much to add. It's just to remind everybody that we should probably keep monitoring the timelines because, as KK and Joy have indicated, the new issues report, which will cover all the rights protection mechanisms from the UDRP to the URS and so forth, is due 18 months after the delegation of the first new PLD. So if you look at ICANN's timeline, if they're looking at 9 months being the non-problematic ones, then you're counting 18 months from that nine-month period. But in addition, there is a requirement in the guidebook that the URS itself, as a single RPM, be reviewed about, I think it's a year, after the first URS decision is handed down. So obviously these timelines are going to march together, but you know, I think we should be keeping an eye on them in preparation for the actual review if it actually takes place. And the other thing I wanted to say is I think Victoria and a couple of other people from NCUC and NCSG have volunteered for the domain name lock working group, so I assume that in future calls, they'll update us as to what the charter is and what it is actually that working group's going to be. So that's it.
Great. Thanks so much for that, Mary. And thanks for also reminding us about that working group. And as I recall, Victoria and some of those other participants have said they would want to, would like other non-commercial stakeholder group members to join the working group. It looks like there's quite a few members from some of the other stakeholder groups, and so there certainly is more opportunity. And if there are others who are interested in this issue, please let the working group chairs or Glenn know, and they'll put you in that working group. Anyone else have anything they wanted to add on this issue? No? Okay. Okay. Then let's go on to the next issue, which is the joint applicant support update. And unfortunately, we don't have Rafiq on the call, and I think Avri's left, so I'm not sure who remaining on the call is best to speak to what's happening on this issue. Bill, Joy, Wendy, can anyone give us an update on the joint applicant support initiatives?
Robin, I can try.
Who's this?
This is Mary. I can try.
Mary, please. Thank you.
Obviously, Avi and Rafiq will have much more information, but just for the benefit of those that might not have been following it, since the program has been launched as of, when was that, Friday, there has been some attempt to have assistance also launched at the same time for needy applicants. So essentially all I want to say is if you go to the new GTLD program website, you see a section there for, you know, the joint applicant support. And also the comment period that just ended, there was some discussion about that on the mailing list. There are some proposals that are out there that the staff have to close on, and those develop from some of the proposals that the JAS working group recommended, but not all are the same. So that, you know, without going into detail, that's probably all I can say. I think that the information in the proposals and on the website is probably the most current, and we're just waiting for, after the comment period has closed last week, for summaries and for any further action by the board on the actual specifics.
Great. Okay, thanks so much for that. Does anyone else have anything they can add to that issue or question on that? Joint applicant.
I'd have to go back and look through the document more carefully, but there were a lot of concerns about the funding and the in particular the question of price cuts and so on, and whether there was whether what ICANN staff is putting forward and the board is putting forward is really sufficient to the need, and I think there was a feeling that it was not. I'm sorry, I'm doing two other things. There's a group through ALAC that Avery and Rafika are also involved with there that put out some pretty good comments summarizing some of the main concerns with the approach that's being taken. And I think this is also on the members list, so people could just follow the link to that. The bottom line is, you know, we made substantial progress from when we first raised this issue, and we're told no go away, there's nothing that can be done, everybody has to pay the same, and that's the end of the story. But obviously, there are ways in which the model being pursued could be a little bit more facilitative to new applicants, needy applicants, and so on. And precise details of exactly how that might be, check the document that was circulated on the membership list. It's getting late here. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Did anyone else have anything to add on this issue?
Yeah, Alain, it's Alain.
Yes, please. Alain, go ahead.
I didn't put, I can't work my hand. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes, I can. Sometimes it's just easier to shout out your name. It's fine with me.
Okay. Just want to let you know that the Jazz group put out a statement very recently, and I think it's been put on our list. I'm not sure. But NPOC had a meeting last week, and we went out of our way to support it. So if I don't know if you've seen it on the list, but and I can put it on the list if you wish.
Great. Thanks very much for that. Was there any other comments on the joint applicant support issue or questions, concerns? Okay. Okay, the next issue on the list is the RAAA amendments or recommendations, and we had some comments happen over the last week on that. Milton and Wendy drafted some comments and submitted them to the public forum, and got a lot of support on the mailing list, and so as a result, both the NCUC and the NCSG sent in an endorsement of the comment. So that was great that we were able to have some good participation on that, and I know the registries had put in a comment, and the intellectual property constituency had put in a comment, and I believe ALAC had put in a comment, so I was really happy that the non-commercial stakeholder group and a constituency, NCUC, was able to also participate and put in some comments on that. Technically, the public comment forum is closed, but in my experience, if you get a comment in the next, you know, day or so they might put it up. So, you know, even though they say it's still closed, it's possible to get things in after the official deadline more often than not. Just an FYI. did anyone have anything to add on this the RAA issue? What's sort of happening next with that?
Robin, this is Milton.
Milton, yes.
Hi. Just have a question. I allocated some time to do those comments and then sent them off and really had to stop paying attention. So what actually did happen? Did the constituency or the stakeholder group actually get it together to endorse those comments or to submit their own comments?
Yeah, both the stakeholder group and the constituency endorsed the comments.
Right.
And I'm not sure if it's on ICANN's website, because it was just this morning that I sent the stakeholder group endorsement, waiting to
Robin,
see if we got any feedback back, and I didn't. So
Robin,
I went ahead and... Yes?
This is Konstantinos. I'm right now on the ICANN website, and all comments are there. And I have to say also for the recording purposes that NCUC officially submitted a statement supporting Wendy's and Milton's comments. Thank you.
Great. That's great. And did you say, I haven't been able to look at the website in the last couple of hours. Does it show that the NCSG supported the statement also? Great. Okay. Wonderful. And then thanks again to Wendy and to Milton for drafting those. Okay. Mary has her hand raised. Okay. Mary, you have the floor.
Yeah, well, actually, it's more of a question, Robin, and it's really because even though it's listed as under, you know, council policy issues, as most people know, really a lot of this stuff has kind of moved to a different forum to direct negotiations between the registrars and ICANN, and I know that some of us have been having discussions with some of the registrars, for example, so it's more of a strategic going forward question for you and everybody else. This is really not something the council is going to be participating in, and therefore, you know, the GNSO as a whole is not technically or officially participating in it. What do we see as next steps for NCSG in terms of moving things forward?
That's a really important point, Mary, that I think you've raised, is that, you know, technically this isn't something that the GNSO is doing. It's sort of a negotiation with the registrars and with ICANN and law enforcement and GAC are sort of, you know, standing there with shotguns behind the staff. But so I think you raise a good question in terms of, you know, what's the role for the GNSO, and more particularly, what's the role for NCSG, and where do we see going with this? I think it's something that non-commercial users care about, and I think all members of the GNSO care about, even though they aren't necessarily represented in these negotiations, because the rules that come out, the policies that, you know, come out of the negotiations will impact every domain name holder in the space. So, you know, it applies to all of us, even though we aren't allowed to participate in directly in the forum. So I think the next question is, you know, so where do we take this, and what can we do? And sort of, you know, with those two questions, I want to open this up and see what kinds of suggestions and ideas we've got. I see Milton's got his hand up. Okay, Milton, you have the floor, and then anyone else, please put your hand up also.
Well, the issue that Mary raised is one of the most confusing things about writing those comments. It was, okay, here we have an issues report that says this is a policy issue for the GNSO, but we also know that the negotiations are going on. So it was very difficult to figure out what to say. And that's why the only thing I could think of to say was, yes, this is an important policy issue. Yes, the GNSO should be making it with all stakeholders represented. And if these people agree things in these private negotiations, which are then not obtaining consensus in the council or in the GNSO, then we have to have the council policy recommendations supersede the private agreements. Now, I don't know if that was whistling in the dark or whether that's true, but can somebody explain to me whether the board, by calling for this, is throwing us a bone, or are they just covering their tracks by telling the GAC and the people who are pressuring them that, okay, we're going to settle this all in private negotiations, and in order to satisfy those people who might disagree with you, we'll have this policy process, but it doesn't really mean anything. That's it for me.
This is Bill. I will just, reply to that, say that I think that it's been made very clear to us in multiple meetings of the council that definitely this is considered by the registrars to be none of our damn business and a private negotiation that we shouldn't be sticking our nose into very much, including even by asking for any measure of transparency.
Well, but the registrars basically want to keep that private because they don't want the IPC and the others breathing down their necks.
They don't want anybody breathing down their neck. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but they would like support. I mean, I have all kinds of evidence of this in individual conversations with registrars, they would like support on the issues regarding, you know, verification, and in particular, they think a lot of that stuff is really burdensome and crazy. So when we make statements like that, I think we are in some ways helping them maybe to negotiate tougher, but also I want to know whether we're also creating an opportunity to back out of things later on.
Well,
that doesn't quite sound right. I mean, to the extent that that sounds as though they'd selectively like our support, but not our input on things where they already have the support they think they need.
Exactly.
So it seems to me that
well, that's politics.
You know, we have a process, you know, we have to negotiate our way into having a formal relationship where not only the good news, but the bad news from their point of view is given some weight.
Well, I know, it's a double-edged sword, and they know that, and we know that, but the point is we shouldn't just assume that the registrars are wanting to keep us out of the process. What they really want to keep out is these law enforcement and IP interests who are, you know, really trying to make them the front line of cybercrime combat at their own expense, and that's one of their biggest concerns. And,
so Milton,
and on that issue, we have a common cause with them.
So, Milton, your view is that they would welcome a close working relationship with public interest groups who are looking for stronger consumer protections and so on?
Of course they would not like that.
So, yeah, thank you. Just to be clear.
If you combine those two issues on this particular point, you're shooting yourself in the foot. If you're saying, let us into the privacy negotiation so that we can impose a bunch of consumer protections on you that you don't want, then they'll say, no, we don't want you in the negotiations. And that's the mistake that people have been making for the last year, I think. If you say to them, we want to help you fight off some of these requirements that law enforcement and IP are putting on you, then they'll say, great.
But they still don't want us around in the room or anything else. They've said that over and over.
But there are places where we share an interest with them, and if we could, putting aside the, you know, they don't want us in the room issue, we share certain objectives. And so if we can, you know, pinpoint those objectives and say, you know, let's do a joint statement on that, or let's agree to do this, you know, it doesn't get us in the room that we want, but it might get us some things that are very important to us, that where we do share some common interests. So, I mean, I kind of understand Milton's viewpoint that, you know, registrars are kind of frustrated with us because we should be on the same side on a lot of these issues, and we spend a lot of our time just kind of trashing them, and it doesn't do us any favors because, you know, we there's so many more things that we do share that if we could instead work on those, I think we'd all be better off.
Just the point, Mary has her hand up and she should be in the queue now, but I just want to say nobody has actually directly engaged with my question, which was assume the worst. Assume they come out of these private negotiations with bad stuff. Will this policy process be able to override it, or is it just a sop? That was my question that I started this with, and I really have no idea. I'm not close enough to the process to know.
Well, I don't know if any of us really know the answer to that question, but I think it's a really good question.
I thought the council members might have a better...
It's something we should all start thinking about for sure. Did anyone have a comment on that?
Robin, this is Mary. I can speculate some. Because I think, Milton, I agree with you, it's confusing. And I don't think any council member, possibly not even a council member from the registrar constituency, can give a definitive answer. I think the confusion arose because of what happened in Dakar, that essentially the frustrations between law enforcement and GAC on one side and the registrars on the other side really boiled over. And there was some sense on the part of the GAC that the GNSO is either adopting some delaying tactics or has such slow processes that nothing's going to happen if we go through a GNSO. So the board, it ended up making a resolution that did two things, which led to the contradiction you noticed. One is that, okay, so we are going to proceed with negotiations directly between the registrars and ICANN. On the other hand, ICANN staff, can you please produce an issue report for the GNSO? And that was all the resolution stated that I recall. So there's no direction from the board as to what was going to happen, meaning that my guess is that a couple of possible scenarios, some of which you've raised. One is that the registrars and the ICANN staff and ICANN generally reach agreement and they say, this is great, you know, we reached agreement. And they might then say, you know what, this agreement is great. This agreement might be based on the RAP working group recommendations, in which case the GNSO has already looked at it. They could do that. Or negotiations could break down or they could be stalled, in which case they could either go back to the RAP working group report, be pressured furthermore by the GAC, or be pressured by everybody else, which is where then some of the side discussions could come in. And I think there is a third possibility, which is as things are going on, that within the GNSO and within the council, we start asking the kind of questions you ask, like, well, okay, we've got this issue report, now what? It's not on the agenda for this month. Is it going to be on the agenda? Is there any point? I mean, we could just start asking those questions while engaging in the direct discussions offline with the registrars themselves, communicating to them that, you know, what some of us have done before, which is we'd like to help insofar as we have mutual interests. I mean, that could be helpful. That could be a signal to the registrars that we're sincere about it. And to help us along with that, I would encourage those who haven't seen it to look at the communications plan that ICANN drafted for the negotiations. And I think, Milton, that's where I think the SOP might be, because if you look at it, as you probably have, it's like, well, we're going to negotiate, but before each meeting, we're going to publish a short statement telling you the topic under negotiation. And if you like, you can submit public comments. I don't know if public comments into that process are going to be that helpful, but I do think that the timelines and the topics that they'll publish can be helpful for us to push the topics either within the council or to talk directly with the registrar. So I still think there are things we can do if we're minded to do it. We just need to track the process in two ways. One is monitoring the communications plan, and second is regular contact with the registrars.
Well, I would put the emphasis on the latter especially, and maybe just send them a note with our comments. Wendy's comments are very good. Send them my comments, whatever. I haven't read the other ones. And say, look, here's where we stand. We hope that you stand firm in these negotiations and uphold these principles that we're interested in. And this is the wrong time to say we should be able to force you to impose consumer protection regulations in your basic contracts. I just think that's not the issue right now at all. They were just excoriated in public by the GAC and the FBI, essentially, for not just following orders. And for us to come up to them and say, yeah, we want you to follow our orders, too, on an issue that's, I don't get it. It seems you guys are missing the point. This is a very important confrontation between the registrars and, the law enforcement community and the U.S. government, and we've got to take the right side.
Milton, this is Mary again, and I agree with you totally, and I know that each of us have been having different conversations. Certainly on my part, when I talked to Mason and Gray and others, I've said exactly what you've just said. And I think that there was wasn't there a meeting or a short discussion, Robin and Wendy, a few of you had with Gray a couple of weeks ago, and I apologize, I couldn't be part of that. I think if we agree that that's the tack, and it looks like what Robin just typed in there is the tack that we want to take, that we constantly do that. And as you say, get back with them and say, here are our comments, and we still mean what we said, and that meeting we had was really constructive. Let's keep going at the very least. One thing that I think we should then think about is which of us on the NCSG side would be the person or the persons preferably monitoring, you know, the stages of things and being the primary contact with the, you know, between the registrars and us. I mean, that shouldn't prevent each of us from individually talking to people we know, but it would be helpful, I think, to have a point or 2 points or 3 points of contact.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mary. And like you said, I think we've started that discussion with Wendy and Hugh and me and Joy and Gray, and I think Constantino was going to try to join that call but wasn't able to, so it just ended up being the three of us. But it was a good start, and I do want to reiterate that, you know, we do have a lot of points in common with the registrars, you know, if we could really support them when they're up against the law enforcement. I was in Dakar and, you know, watched as, you know, law enforcement just completely blew up and, you know, threatening registrars with everything under the sun. And, you know, they're scared. And you know, rightfully so. And, you know, we're sort of the only, if we don't support them, nobody at ICANN is going to support them, because, you know, everyone else is going to cave. They're going to have some kind of, you know, financial or connection, interest to want to cave. And so, you know, it's true, the registrars are not going to do good things because they have good hearts, but because it makes business sense. And there are places where it is in their business sense to not give in to law enforcement. And so we need to find those places and support them in those places. And yet they're doing it for business reasons, and we're doing it for more humanitarian concerns. And we're not going to, you know, get hung up on this distinction and hung up on whether or not we're allowed in the room and other issues that are going to keep us from achieving real objectives and real results in places where we could if we just kind of focused our attention in those places. Did anyone else have anything they wanted to add on this issue? Okay, great. The next thing in the on the agenda is what's open for public comment now, and then Milton has also requested that we add the issue of the Finance Committee. So let's quickly go take a look at the ICANN, what's open for public comment now, and see what we need to be working on, or what comments are coming up due that we may want to weigh in on. It was, like I said, it was great that we got an NCSG and an NCUC comment in over the weekend on the RIA issue. Okay, so right now it looks like the issues are the IDN variant issues report, the initial report on universal acceptance of IDNs, and the Who Is Policy Review Team draft report. That one's due March 18th. Correct me if I'm wrong, gang, but I'm thinking that it's this Who Is issue that's open for public comment now is one that we're most concerned with, most focused on, although I'm happy for somebody to tell me we should be doing comments on these other two IDN issues as well, and, you know, at which time you get volunteered. So, okay, does anyone have anything on these, what's open for public comment now? Wendy, are you working on the Who Is One? I seem to recall us talking about this in December, the end of December. Oh, I'm not sure you're on the call. Actually, you may have dropped off the call. Anyone know?
Robin, this is JK. Yes, she is. Wendy's working on the quiz.
Great. Okay, thank you. Yes, I see that now, her comment. Okay, so Wendy's working on that, and am I wrong? Should we be thinking about doing something on these IDN reports? It isn't something that we've typically commented on in the past, but if we've got something to say, let's take the opportunity to say it. Anyone have anything to say on this issue? Doesn't look like it. Okay. Then let's move on to the issue that we added to the agenda, the Finance Committee issue, and that was raised by Milton, so I'm going to let Milton have the floor on that and say what it is that he wanted to discuss.
Sure, yeah. So the Finance Committee has been having some conversations about raising money for the NCSG, and there was a debate, I guess you'd call it, or a difference of opinion between me and another person on the committee that I just wanted to air. That has to do with membership. Mr. Stoll, who's on the Finance Committee, I think just through sort of lack of experience, but I shouldn't assume that, and I shouldn't denigrate his views, but he really seems to believe that NCSG should charge for membership, and that paid membership in NCSG would be a gateway through which you'd have to join the constituencies, and that would also be the primary way for us to develop funds for doing NCSG activities. And my view has been very opposed to that. We had experience charging membership dues with the old NCHDNHC or whatever the heck the acronym was, and it really is a barrier to participation. It's a hassle administratively. You've got, you know, checks for $50 coming from Zimbabwe or Hungary, and it's always a real problem to administer those kinds of currency conversions. And by the time you're done with that, you've basically effectively gotten 25 cents or maybe $2 out of that membership fee. So I just view it as a completely self-negating way to finance. And I think the alternative model that I proposed was to simply have each constituency cough up $1,000 or $2,000 to the secretariat of the NCSG, and that would provide the basis for a fairly minimal operative structure for the stakeholder group, and that was really all we needed. So I just wanted to get people's opinions about that.
Milton, this is Klaus. This is Mr. Stoll. I think you are completely misrepresenting the views I voiced in my email. The views are voiced, which I voiced in my email were the following. I said that there is a difference made in the charter of the NGSG between large and small organizations, and that we should think about making a contribution, a finance contribution, obligatory for larger organizations, and that all other contributions should be made on a voluntary basis, so that those organizations and so on who want to do that should do it on a voluntary basis. So this would give us a little bit of regular income, which I think can be managed. I think it is if you do it as an individual and things like that, and you have to deal with $50 check, it might be cumbersome, but it can be done. It is a question of getting your administration right. And what I was talking about is making a contribution to the NGSG voluntarily, but asking the larger organizations to make a cash contribution, because I think it is fair that large organizations who have a real interest and impact from what's going on in the NGSG also support the work of the NGSG. And by the way, I reject Jack Sayer's comment about the lack of experience. I'm dealing with these things and the membership things and exactly that kind of membership since many, many years, and I know how it's done and how it can be done. And an organization who can't deal with $50 checks should revise its admin policies.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. I think Alan has his hand raised. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you, Milton, for this. I think in the age of remits and the internet, I think it's the transfer of funds, the small amounts, can be done through the, you know, through PayPal or through Visa. It's relatively easy. But the point is not to create a barrier, in my opinion. The point is to walk the talk, because if we are going to, and I speak for NPOC here more than for NCSG, at least I feel comfortable doing speaking at least for NPOC, is that in order to achieve outreach outcomes, and you know ICANN wants to increase outreach, you've heard about my views about bringing in many more NGOs from smaller NGOs from developing and emerging economies. And in order to do that, we're going to have to do some fundraising. And in order for the fundraising to occur, you have to walk that talk. So in other words, you know, a donor will say, well, how do you raise funds? Will I be the only funder? Are you doing your best? And we can say, yes, well, at least we have membership fees. Our members are paying some dues. So it's a door opener to fundraising. So that's why I support it too. I support what Klaus is proposing.
Thank you very much, Alan.
By the way, Robin, you know, we constituencies have different personalities, obviously, and I don't know what the experience is in other stakeholders group, but you know, we don't have to. Constituencies don't have to do the same thing all the time. We don't have to be. We don't have to be twins, you know. And if NCUC does not want to do fundraising and does not want to do membership fees, who am I to disagree?
Okay, thank you very much. And we've got another hand raised from Tim. Go ahead.
Right, so from my point of view, we're having a cart before the horse discussion here. I haven't heard why we need to raise money. I haven't heard what the money would be used for, and I will certainly say that before I donate, I need to see a very clear value proposition that says, you know, why should I take money out of my grocery budget and put it here?
Okay, good point. Konstantinos, looks like you're next in the queue.
Thanks, Robin. Actually, Tim said what I wanted to say, and on top of that, I would I'm quite confused again, because, you know, in the beginning of this call, we had the discussion, you know, between commercial and non-commercial and all, which is fair enough, but also I've been hearing from different places how difficult it is for some of the organizations that are participating in the NCSG, these large organizations, that they're claiming that they don't have money for to do various other things. So I'm quite surprised how we can ask those very organizations that claim to have financial problems to actually start donating also. But the more important thing is what Tim actually said. I am trying to see what will be the value for this money and what we're going to do with them. Thanks.
Thank you. The last hand raised is Alan.
Well, if NCSG is a value proposition when it doesn't cost anything, and when there is contributions by large organizations and voluntary subscriptions, then it has no value. I mean, it's not getting value for money. It's being able to do to say we are asking donors to contribute, and we have done our share, our members do their share. So we're talking about symbolic amounts anyway, and that gives a starting working capital. The second point, the objective is outreach. And I think, you know, when you think of our outreach right now, I personally think it can be increased a lot. You know, NPOC did a a webinar on the 6th of December to explain ICANN for NGOs. And, you know, we did it all through voluntary work and artwork and scraping the bottoms of barrels. And we got 206 participants in that webinar. And that's doing it with zero cash budget. So that's not sustainable. We need people can't go on, you know, 3 and 4 hours of sleep to increase ICANN outreach. So that's the logic behind it. It's a fundraising logic.
This is Klaus, and I think I would second that very much, because the point is still the case, and even if it's boring and even if it is repetitive, nobody still knows what's going on in ICANN, and let alone in the not-for-profit sector. And despite what ICANN will do in the outreach, we need to do our own outreach activities, and we need to have funds to do all these things. And so for me, the question of horse and cart isn't there. But I'm very, very glad this point was brought up, because that is a good point to say, okay, well, let's write down what we need this money for.
Okay, and so we've got two people in the queue, Milton and then Bill.
Okay, so, I apologize to Klaus. I did misunderstand a key element of his proposal, which I thought that the membership fee was required as a gateway into the whole stakeholder group. And if he's saying it's only compulsory for large organizations and not for the small ones and individuals, then that's a substantial change. I still think it's de facto going to be voluntary for everybody, in effect, unless you're willing to say, you know, to, let's say, the YMCA, you haven't paid your dues, we're kicking you off the list. You know, it's going to function as a suggested contribution, and I have no argument with suggested contributions. I do think that if we're interested in outreach, we don't want to put a financial barrier up between participation in the constituency and the membership and the stakeholder group. And the other issue is, I think Tim has raised a very good point, which is what is this money for? And again, I'm so confused now about the whole outreach issue. People talk about outreach, it reminds me of one of these Ponzi schemes in which nobody knows what we're doing, but we're trying to get more and more people to do it. Our job is to formulate policy, and when the policies are important and affect people, then we spread the word and people start to participate. But when we do outreach for outreach's sake, it becomes just a bureaucracy building exercise. And I hear that there's a conversation about outreach at the GNSO level, there's a conversation about outreach at the stakeholder group level, and there's a conversation at the constituency level. And I think one of the biggest problems with getting people involved is, in fact, the multi-layered complexity of getting involved. And I just, I'm unwilling to build up another bureaucratic structure within ICANN, when it's not clear exactly what it's doing that isn't already being done in other ways.
Well, I think you raise a kind of a really interesting point, Milton, in that, you know, who is supposed to be doing the outreach? Where should our, you know, personal, individual outreach efforts go? Should they go to getting people to join NCSG? Should they go to getting people to join constituencies? And I think the answer is the latter, and this is just my own personal opinion, and I'm happy to, you know, hear lots of other opinions. But, you know, it seems to me that much of what we're talking about needs to be done at the constituency level. I think we all agree we need to do outreach. We all agree we need to bring in new voices, underrepresented voices, voices from developing countries. We all agree to these things. The question is, you know, okay, who does that? And I think that the emphasis of that is, you know, supposed to be at the constituency level. It was something that the board, you know, really didn't want to let go of in when they did the whole GNSO restructuring, which was really trying to keep the policy development as granular and as close to the constituency level as possible. So you know, yeah, we need to be doing all of these things, but we should be doing them through, or we would be best be doing much of them, most of them, through the constituency process. Now, I think there are some things that NCSG needs, and, you know, I made a proposal to the Finance Committee that we try to get, that we make a proposal for funding from ICANN so we can get officer some executive committee travel to the ICANN meeting so we can actually run the meeting. But again, this is, you know, just kind of like one very small sort of, you know, functional and practical how we can carry out our existing work and you know. And that's the kind of thing that I think we should be, you know, if we need to be doing fundraising, it should be for these, you know, that sort of thing at the SG level, and then, you know, at the constituency level, perhaps the larger, more outreach elements. I had Bill in the queue, and then I have Alan, and did anybody else want to get in after that?
Yeah, Klaus.
Klaus, okay. Bill, you're up.
Okay. I'm going to get off this call in 1 minute because it's almost 11 o'clock here and I have something else to do. So I would be happy to talk about outreach at some length, but I'm not going to be able to do it now. I would only ask if there was a if MPOC ran a webinar about ICANN for NGOs with 200 people. Is there a URL for an archive of that discussion that could be shared with the rest of us so that perhaps we could get a better understanding of how you're thinking about these issues and what the costs and the means of outreach, financial outreach that you have in mind are. That would be very helpful. More information sharing would be really good. Also, with regard to responding to statements, policy statements. The 1 minute, half a minute left, I'm going to just say that we skipped an item where there's a motion because we've talked about organizational matters the entire time and not really policy stuff. But there is a motion on cross-community working groups, which I would encourage people to take a look at, and if they have any concerns about it, to send feedback to the members list so that councilors can take that into account before voting for it. The bottom line is that we had a long battle over cross-community working groups after the REC 6 group and after the JAS group, and many people in the GNSO Council regarded these as sort of infringing on the prerogatives of the council and of stakeholder groups, and of spilling into somehow or leaning towards policy development and otherwise being inappropriate. Many of us felt that and argued at length that actually in the case of JAS, that if the kinds of uniform and rigorous approach that the council seems to want had been followed, that probably the JAS would have never moved because ALAC would not have been able to go forward with its own recommendations, et cetera. So I think there are some real issues here. But bottom line is what's been proposed now is that all cross-community working groups have to have a single joint charter, but presumably the different groups can report out separately. There's some questions as to whether a single joint charter isn't rather restrictive, but we may not have time to get into that now. So anyway, I would just encourage people to take a look at that, and I'm going to have to hang up in about 15 seconds. Thanks.
Thanks so
okay,
much,
before you hang up, just to address your transparency issues, the whole webinar is available. You can actually follow it online, and the whole webinar was just about explaining why internet governance is important to the nonprofit sector. There were no policy issues discussed during that webinar or before or after.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Klaus. Could you send the URL to the list so we can have a look? It'd be good to share.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Great. And I believe Alan had something else to say on this.
No, I think it's getting too late, and it was just a small point.
Okay.
That's fine. Thank you.
Then, if there are no other questions or hands raised, I will call this meeting to a close. And thank you all for participating and for staying the full 2 hours and for, you know, going through these issues with me. I do appreciate it. And, you know, I know it's not everyone's favorite topic or exciting stuff, but it needs to be done. And so I really appreciate all your engagement and input. And let's take this discussion online. And thank you all. Have a good week.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.